Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Tux Lerzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Signing on.
Yes.
We be drankin'. We probably be swearing.
I be swearing.
The jury's out on me for...
Sometimes you swear, and it's confusing for me. I'm just like, you've just body snatched. Yes. By an adult.
As you hopefully know by now, this is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. Should we cheers?
Yes, let's do it.
Ta-da!
We did it.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
So today we are drinking the Martinez, it's called. It is the precursor to the martini, but this is called a Martinez.
Let's take a little sip.
Frosty glass.
Oh, that is delightful.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
So good. So good. I don't even taste the gin.
Yeah. Uh-oh. It is the precursor to the martini, but in reality, it's actually closer to a Manhattan than a martini. It's basically...
I taste the vermouth.
Yeah, it's basically a Manhattan, but made with Old Tom Gin instead of whiskey. For those of you who don't know, Old Tom Gin is like an older style of gin that was popular before the London Dry Gin that everybody knows today. If you're a gin drinker, most likely you're drinking London Dry. Old Tom Gin is sweeter and a little richer and less junipery.
Junipery, yeah.
There is juniper, but not nearly as much.
It's more subtle.
Yeah.
It's real drinkable, you guys.
Oh my God. It's so good, yeah. I made this to photograph it for the Instagram, but I didn't taste it earlier.
Oh.
I got a little bit on my fingers and was like, and knew that it tasted good, but that was my first sip.
It's so good. Yeah. It's so good. Oh no.
Very drinkable, yeah. So it is made with Old Tom Gin, sweet vermouth, like you would use for a Manhattan, and a maraschino liqueur. So that's why it tastes kind of cherry-y.
What's the name of the liqueur again?
Luxardo.
Luxardo,
like
yes,
those
yes.
fancy like Italian cherries, yeah. The origin story of the Martinez, like a lot of cocktails, like I said, I'm like a broken record that these origin stories are kind of hard to pin down.
Because people were drinking and lying?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not lying.
Maybe not lying. Misremembering.
There we go. Yeah.
Yes.
Jerry Thomas, who I've mentioned before, is a famous bartender. He's written cocktail books. Some people say that Jerry Thomas invented the Martinez in San Francisco for a customer who was traveling to Martinez, California in the early 1880s. But he didn't actually publish the recipe until 1887. And another bartender did publish a recipe in 1884. So some people are like, well, Jerry Thomas didn't do it because O.H. Byron published this other Martinez recipe in 1884. But it's also possible that Byron had it from Jerry Thomas, but beat him to the punch when it came to publishing.
Okay.
So there's sort of a lot of back and forth. If you look, some recipes are like, no, O.H. Byron.
Yeah.
But then there's also the city of Martinez in California claims that just like a local bartender invented the drink there in their city. So
okay, yeah.
Byron's recipe that he published in 1884, it's a sentence. The whole recipe is a sentence. Same as Manhattan, only use substitute gin for whiskey.
Wow. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And it's very, very tasty.
It's super good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it would work with London Dry Gin. Might be okay.
The flavors would be odd, I think, a little. I don't know, but maybe.
I feel like sweet vermouth and dry gin that's like junipery, they're not going to play well together.
Yeah, that's true.
There's also another even older kind of gin called Genever that was more popular even before Old Tom. I saw
like
some recipes from like the 1600s or something.
Whoa.
It's like a Dutch recipe.
Wow.
Some recipes say to use Genever. Supposedly
have you tried it?
I've never had
it.
Oh,
okay.
But people are saying it tastes really malty. It's made from a different spirit.
Like beer?
Almost like a wine byproduct. Because usually gin is made with vodka as the base, or like a clear grain alcohol as the base. But this was saying that Genever is like a totally different base spirit entirely.
Okay.
I want to try it, but I didn't want to risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Try it first on your own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'll try to ruin my good time.
Just kidding. So yeah.
Yeah.
From California in the 1880s.
Oh, how dare you? This is so perfect for my story. Does the name Wong Kim Ark mean anything to you.
Wong Kim Ark. No, I can't say that it does.
For shame. For shame.
Is he from California in the 1880s?
Truly is, yes.
Oh, look at that.
My scandal this episode is twofold. I will explore the little-known landmark Supreme Court case, Wong Kim Ark versus the United States. It's arguably one of the most overlooked of civil rights cases in American history. It's really kind of shameful. Wong, who despite being born in San Francisco, was denied re-entry to the U.S. in 1895 after a trip to China solely because of his race.
Uh-huh. Ain't I can't. That no, that doesn't sound like the United States at all.
A bitch. Yes. Could you imagine, like, as much as I fly, like, to get back to JFK and they're like, no black people allowed.
That's in. Yeah.
Bitch, get out of my face.
Where am I supposed to go? I am from here.
Yeah. All of my things are here. What are you talking about? Things and family and friends and life.
My plants. My
That's the first thing I say. My plants. That tracks. That sounds like me. So I will use Wong's scandal to talk about the Chinese Exclusion Act, the law that made it illegal for Chinese workers to come to the U.S. and for Chinese nationals already living here to ever become citizens.
Damn. I know a little bit. Yeah.
But you just know, like, broad strokes.
I know it was a scandal. And oh, I know okay. that it's, like, a good enough one that we should discuss it at some point.
Yes. But. So this was the first and only major federal law that banned immigration based solely on nationality. Up until then, the country welcomed immigrants. All immigrants.
Up until...
Well, this law went into effect in 1882.
Wow.
Yeah. Immigration was open. Anyone could come here. Yet we're pointing at the Chinese and saying... No, not you.
Yeah.
Literally anyone but you. Yeah. The Chinese Exclusion Act would be signed into law as Lady Liberty's torched hand sat in New York.
Wow.
In Madison Square.
Okay. Yeah.
Back then, we didn't have the term anchor baby, which is fucked up.
Yeah.
So fucked up. It's like so derogatory. But we didn't have that term. They had another really fucked up derogatory term. Accidental citizen. Citizen by accident of birth. The accident, of course, was being born non-white in a white supremacist country. Go on.
That's it's just like an anchor baby essentially is like you had a baby on purpose so you could stay.
Oh, yes.
So calling it an accidental citizen
having babies
would be like
so fun.
Yeah. But like, yeah. I really do think that there's that mentality that, I mean, yeah. if you're somebody who's saying the words anchor
yeah, no,
baby.
Yeah, no, it's derogatory. It's never positive.
It's like you're saying that you got pregnant, carried a small human being around in your womb for 9 months, ejected it from your vagina.
Let it break free from your body.
And then raised it.
Yes.
Because America is so fucking awesome to immigrants. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Oh my God. It's so laughable. So before I dive into Wong's story and how he found himself barred from the country of his birth, I need to lay a very quick foundation about just like U.S.-Chinese relations. So did you know that there would be no United States without China? Like none. Our country's relationship with them was instrumental in keeping our young republic afloat.
In what way?
Independence severed our ties with the British Empire and all their fancy trading partners. Huh. So we were on our own.
Yeah.
And we had to find new allies to trade with that weren't colonized.
Okay.
It was President Polk who was really interested in finding a quicker and cheaper route for Chinese trade. He had a plan to secure spices and teas and silks and porcelain and all, you know, the fancy shit the Tuxes of their day would need to live their best lives.
How dare you? But you're also
like,
accurate.
Yeah, right? You're like...
I like nice things, okay?
There's nothing wrong with that. Ain't mad at it. Step one was finding a fast, cheap way to import these goods. Because free trade at that time was like the full expression of liberty. Like that was the thing that made us feel free.
Yeah.
Imagine that, free trade with China. That was then though, you know, that was then. Step two was a plan to establish Chinese colonies in port cities here. They wanted to have these colonies so it would be an easy way to import Chinese labor, like Chinatowns.
Wow.
So that's why Chinatowns are always in port cities.
Wow.
Yeah, because they needed them.
I've never heard that
right?
before.
Right? Yes. So this is all by design. Like, this whole scandal really just, it opened my eyes in so many ways. And this is just, just the beginning. So these workers who would come here and live in these Chinese colonies, they would be used to develop the West Coast. Because the West Coast was giant and it was so resource rich, yet scarcely populated. You know, scarcely populated. There was few people there.
Sure. Because
it was like a wild area and it wasn't going to develop itself, that area.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's so big. we saw an opportunity to be financially independent through our trade relationship with China.
Yeah.
Who at the time, this was very convenient for us, at the time China was fighting with the British. So it was perfect for us to be like, yeah, fuck these guys.
Yeah. Yeah, we hate them too.
We hate them too. We hated them first. Yeah. But, you know, who's counting? Yeah. But also we hated them first. So the war in China created a lot of instability. Many citizens were trying to get out. They were fleeing poverty and violence. And it was easy to just hop a ship over here to the West Coast. According to the census in 1840, guess how many Chinese immigrants were living in the U.S.?
In 1840?
Yeah, in 1840. It's a low number.
Okay.
It's just for my own amusement.
500,000.
Okay, that's really high.
Oh.
Okay. I'm going to let you try again.
I'm thinking that's like really low.
It is low for today's... This is 1840.
Okay.
At the time, there were 17 million people in California. How many Chinese do you think were?
Man, I'm still thinking 500,000 is like a good number. 100,000.
Four. Correct. Four.
Not 4,000.
Four. Solitary four. There were four there. One ship came over.
What?
Yeah. But 12 years later, there was 20,000.
500,000.
Yeah. That's why I'm like, I'm going to let you try again because you're going to be real embarrassed when I say four. So 12 years later, there are 20,000 Chinese immigrants working here. These workers first came to work the gold fields, to mine.
Uh-huh.
Gold was like a global phenomenon, like the fact that they were finding it in California and on the West Coast. Everyone heard about it. Like the Mexicans who were living in California, they were there. Like people from Europe were coming over for it. People from Canada are coming down. So these Chinese people, they came to work. They were really good at finding gold for no like crazy reason other than the fact that like the stakes were higher.
Yeah.
They had to send money home to their families. They had to pay for their trip. Usually, like, their trips were financed by Chinese merchants, so they had to pay them back.
Okay, yeah.
So, these financial pressures left them little choice other than to work for whatever they could work for whatever money, basically. So, white laborers, they required a much higher salary because they had bargaining power, they had, like, political clout, they could negotiate better wages, whereas the Chinese were willing to take what they could, what they were offered. Therefore, many white workers came to resent their Chinese counterparts. At first, the Chinese were tolerated. They were seen as hardworking, generous, energetic people who had a strong moral code. But then things shift with the gold rush.
They took our gold.
They took our gold. Basically, yes, that gold was for them, as the Cherokee Nation learned when it was found on their land. If you're like, what? Listen to episode 7 of season 1. I talk about the Trail of Tears when they found gold where the Cherokee were. Didn't end well. So as a result, Chinese workers were gradually forced to leave the mining areas because the white workers convinced the big mining outfits to not hire the Chinese.
Okay.
They're like, this is not for them. So they left these mining areas and they went into urban hubs such as San Francisco and L.A., because there was a threat of violence and there was real safety in numbers. They moved into these urban cities, often performing some of the dirtiest and like the hardest work. Because again, they had to make money it somehow. And this led to them being stereotyped as dirty, exotic, dangerous, and like fierce job competitors. Which sounds familiar, right? Sounds a little too familiar. So large numbers of unemployed Chinese miners were then recruited to build the Transcontinental Railroad that connected the Atlantic with the Pacific. The Chinese were reliable. They were strong. 9 out of the 10 workers on the railroad were Chinese.
Wow.
The others were Irish. Yeah. So Chinese would work for lower rates. So it shouldn't be shocking that they could only afford to live in like certain areas, like basically slums.
Yeah.
And they were called coolies. It's a racist slur for Asian laborers, basically.
Okay.
This is when the coolie problem became a thing.
Do you know what it stems from, or like what it meant?
It's,
not that we need to...
I mean, I looked into it, and it seems like it came from the islands. It's like almost like an indentured servant.
Okay.
Like you're paid a wage, but you're paid a very low wage.
Sure, okay.
It's more of like a class sort of thing, but this was racialized because this was only for Asians.
Because it happened in America, so.
Correct. It was racialized because it happened in America.
Yeah.
Yes, that is true.
That's just what we
do. So undesirable as they were, these Chinese workers, they built one hell of a railroad. They cut through the Sierra Nevadas like butter. Like, wow. They did it in half the time. It's crazy. Again, they were performing the dangerous, like the most dangerous jobs. And like, yeah, they were just doing what they needed to do to survive in this country. And they connected the country. The bastards,
yeah,
making everything so good for us here. So when the railroad was complete, there was an official photo op. How many Chinese people think are pictured?
Four.
Zero.
Zero, yeah. I was going to guess zero, and then I was like, maybe they threw one or two in for good measure.
Nope, nope, nope. Mm. We, the whites, built this.
Yeah.
Eye roll. So despite needing these workers to make America literally what it is, California was still so bothered by Chinese presence in their state.
Yeah.
At the height, they were 20% of the population, the Chinese.
Okay.
And they
that's significant. That's
It is significant. It is significant.
Not that makes it okay to be resentful of their presence, but...
Yeah, so the state passed a series of measures aimed at Chinese residents, ranging from requiring special licenses for Chinese businesses or workers, or just preventing their naturalization. Because everyone else, all the other immigrants, were able to become citizens at some point.
Okay.
By just being in the country through the process. But thankfully, this was illegal federally. California was trying to go rogue with it, but it was illegal federally because your man, Willie H. Seward.
Do you know, I hate to interject here. Click, click. His home is a big museum in my hometown.
We should be.
The next time, if you ever go to Auburn with me at any point, we should go there.
Yeah,
because
I
talk about him incessantly.
So Seward negotiated a really favorable treaty with China. Before then, there were all these treaties that were really unequal. Uh-huh. Like the ones that the Chinese had with the British were like crazy predatory. Like China got nothing. But this is like he negotiated like a real treaty that protected the Chinese here.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
So that's why what they were trying to do in California couldn't stand, because he put together a treaty that protected Chinese citizens. They granted them the right to free immigration so they could come and go as they want, and free travel within the U.S., amongst other things. Like they were able to be educated here.
Uh-huh.
And English people who wanted to go to China, they were able to be educated in China. Like it was reciprocal.
Sure.
Basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this treaty was initially. This drink is really, really strong. And I've had like 2.5 sips and I'm just like, woo, my shirt's off. So this treaty was initially celebrated by industrial leaders because it ensured a steady flow of low-cost Chinese immigrant labor for all sorts of companies, not just the West Coast.
Okay.
So after building the railroads, the Chinese worked in the South on plantations. They worked in the North in factories.
Wow.
Yeah, because slavery has been canceled.
Sure, yeah. So they need
cheap labor because they're just like...
And people that they can treat like dirt.
Correct. Yeah, because it's like, wait, no, white people have rights and we can't, you know, terrorize them. So many Chinese people here became entrepreneurs themselves, working in stores that serve their communities, like Wong Kim Ark's family. Although they only made up a small fraction of the immigrants federally, like within the whole country, they were the largest non-white group of newcomers, which made them the target of the usual fact-free panic that you would expect.
Yeah.
So they were...
fact-free.
I mean, it is fact-free,
no,
right?
No, I mean,
it is fact-free. Like, they bring disease, and they were going to degrade the culture and crime, and there's going to be all this white lady rape. Like, you know, the usual. Tale as old as time.
I was just going to say, yeah, it's a broken record.
Song as old as rhyme.
Yes.
Ooh, look barely at you. Even friends. No, let's go.
Literally, we're not friends. This is what we do in America when it comes to immigrants, especially immigrants that are not white.
It's like, where have I seen this before? Where? Some call the Chinese who came here to work and live peacefully like everyone else, they called them an unarmed invasion.
Jesus.
And those weren't just words, because armed vigilantes routinely attack Chinese immigrants with no repercussions. They could just kill and lynch and do all sorts of things. And newspapers and politicians, they fan the flames of division, as they do. There were lynchings and massacres up and down the West Coast.
Holy shit.
Like,
people don't know about this.
Like, kids, women, for no reason other than that they're not white. So they also did this thing that they call expulsions.
Okay.
Where all the white people in the town would go to all the Asians in town and tell them that, well, they were given a choice. They could keep their businesses and their homes, or they can keep their lives. And they had 24 hours. So this happened all over the West Coast.
People don't talk about this shit because this is like they have just borrowed the playbook of like the South, essentially.
Exactly, yeah.
On the West Coast, too.
No, on the West Coast, yeah. Wow. So needless to say, the success of the treaty was short-lived. The tide was turning. Anti-Chinese sentiment continued to spread as white working men everywhere, because it's not just the West Coast now, like they're in the South, they're in the Northeast, they're everywhere. White working men targeted Chinese people as scapegoats, especially in the wake of the Depression of 1873. Because of all of this anti-Chinese sentiment, the U.S. passed their first ever immigration law. This is the Page Act of 1875, which barred the entry of Chinese women.
Women
who immigration officials perceived as immoral or likely to engage in prostitution.
What?
Before immigration was free, anyone could come here. You could just bring your whole family and come here. But the treaty was only for Chinese men to come over and work. So they don't want Chinese women to come here because they're all prostitutes. And then there's going to be babies. These accidental citizen babies all over.
Sure.
So, yeah. So our first immigration bill is like not only so racist, it's so sexist. Because every Chinese woman is just a prostitute. That's the only reason they'd be coming here. Yeah.
Fuck.
I know. It's so messed up. It's insane.
I just did a swear.
Oh, wow.
Get a gold star.
So for the people who are using Tux's swears as a drinking game, now you can take one sip.
I said the same swear twice.
That doesn't count. No, okay, it counts. Okay, two sips for you guys. Yes. Two sips. So Senator John F. Miller of California argued that Chinese workers were, quote, machine-like of obtuse nerve. Do you know what obtuse means? It means like less sensitive.
Yeah.
Okay. So they thought that, and this is so sick, they thought that Chinese people, that their nerves were further from their skin. Therefore, they could tolerate higher pain.
Fuck you.
Thank you. What yeah. So they were machine-like of obtuse nerve, little affected by heat or cold, wiry, sinewy, with muscles of iron, end quote. When I found this quote, I laughed. But then I was just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, if I could talk to Senator Miller, I would tell him, like, just because you are a weak, racist sack of slop doesn't mean that Chinese people are unaffected by cold, you dumb bitch.
Oh my God.
You know? Maybe think less about the Chinese and more about, like, what's wrong with your mind?
Yeah, just because your body looks like somebody poured loose mashed potatoes into a pair of nylons.
Yeah, truly. It's so, so gross. But yeah, I digress. So the Chinese must go became this like rallying cry. It was in all the newspapers. This was in the years that Wong spent growing up in San Francisco, thanks to stupids like Miller.
Stupids.
So I have stupids in all caps with two O's and ends in a T.
Yes.
Stupids. Thanks to stupids like Miller, California was overflowing with really racist propaganda and despicable like cartoons. I'll upload some of them to Instagram, but this shit is wild.
Yeah.
It's really crazy. So decades of xenophobia and racism became federal law in 1882 when President Chester A. Arthur signed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which barred Chinese laborers from entering the company and becoming naturalized American citizens. This law was the first time that the U.S. excluded a whole group of immigrants based solely on nationality. It created a new permanent class of aliens on racial lines, and it led to the first large-scale deportation in American history.
Wow. Good times.
Yeah. Cool, right? So the Chinese Exclusion Act, it lasted for 10 years, and then it was extended for another 10 years by the Geary Act, which also required that the Chinese carry identification certificates or face deportation. So they had to carry something on them at all times or they could be deported. Cool, right? Real cool.
Oh, my God.
Yes, yes. Cool, cool.
They had to, like, sew it onto their coat.
No, not yet. But, yes, basically. You know, sew onto their coat so it's always there and it's easy for them.
Yeah.
We're helping them. So later measures added other restrictions, such as limiting their access to bail bonds in the courts and allowing entry only to, like, professionals, like teachers or students or diplomats and tourists. However, none of these really racist laws stopped Chinese immigrants from trying to build lives here, which is amazing. So 13 years after the Exclusion Act, Wong Kim Ark showed up on a boat in the port of San Francisco. Wong was 22 years old at the time. He was the son of parents from the Pearl River Delta, which is near Canton. He no doubt looked like every other Chinese man. But Wong was born in San Francisco. His parents had come to the country decades earlier to manage a grocery store in Chinatown in San Francisco. They had entered the U.S. long before federal immigration services had a concept such as illegal immigration. Everyone was just coming. So because all these laws had been changed, his parents were not allowed to become citizens under the racial laws. They feared very real vigilante violence.
Yeah.
So they fled with their son back to China in 1890. And this is when he was 17.
Okay.
But for Wong, San Francisco was his home. So sure. he returned to California just after a few months of being in China. He came back. And he was admitted without any problem. All of his papers were in order because he had to carry papers now.
Yeah.
So he became a restaurant cook. And thinking that he was free to travel like other Americans, he sailed to China in November of 1894 to see his family. He had taken the precaution of, before departing San Francisco, he prepared the now necessary ID document. It's like a one-page typed thing that has his photo in the middle. And then it has it's signed by a notary. And you have to get three white San Francisco residents who all affirmed that he was born in the city and well known to him.
Jesus Christ.
How fucking demeaning.
Oh my God.
Could you imagine like having to go to your neighbor? It's like, I've known you for 17 years. Can you have like everyone in your family sign this document that I am born here just like you, but I'm just Chinese? Yeah.
Oh God.
I know. I feel like all of the moisture was just sucked. I'm going to have a drink.
This cocktail is so fucking strong. I don't know if it's the ridiculousness of this story or the strength of this cocktail, but I'm like,
this story is a lot. And I'm sipping small sips because I taste the power in it. And also it's so good.
Its nerves are under the skin. It's very strong in that way.
Oh man. So this document, this really gross document, in addition to all of this, it had to be signed by an inspector upon his departure from San Francisco. And yet, when he returned home, he ran into John H. Wise, the man in charge of customs at the time. Wise was a notorious racist. He was originally from Virginia, and he moved to California. In the absence of black people, he decided that he can just terrorize Chinese. Seriously.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Hated the Chinese because they were Chinese and not white, basically. So as customs chief, he ruled that Wong was not a citizen and thus immediately deportable under the new Exclusion Act.
But on what basis? He has all the documentation. Everything is in order. He like did.
The basis is that he's Chinese.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Yeah, this guy thought he was real big. He had Wong arrested by a marshal and confined to a boat in the bay. And Wong wasn't having it. He did the most American thing he could do. He sued.
Good for him.
Yeah. And this is how you know he's a real one.
Yeah. You'd be like, oh, that sucks. Okay, I guess back to China.
Yeah. Oh, fuck that. No, yeah. I'm from here like you, bitch, okay? I'm not going anywhere, Wise. Like, wow. So his lawyer argued that Wong was entitled to enter the country according to the 14th Amendment.
Do you know how he got a lawyer? Like, how was he able to?
Oh, yes, I do know.
Okay.
Because there was such a large population of Chinese people, there were these, like, immigrant rights groups that had popped up.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Because they had been there for 50 years.
Yeah. Like, the ACLU is like, hey, I'm here for you if you need it.
Yeah, exactly. So they found him a lawyer because he was born here.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So his lawyer argued, again, that he was entitled to be here because he was born in this country in the 14th Amendment. I like to think that his lawyer just, like, read the 14th Amendment and, like dropped the mic.
This is what our Constitution says.
Yeah.
Welcome to America.
Because it explicitly said that all people born or naturalized in the United States are United States citizens.
Yeah.
This amendment was one of the newly minted Reconstruction era ones that, that followed the 13th Amendment outlawing slavery. So despite... This is so maddening. Despite all of this, it had to go to the Supreme Court because he kept losing.
Who are these fucking judges?
They're white.
The Constitution. It's not hard.
I know.
This is what it says.
I know. So anti-immigrant forces, they had been gearing up for this fight. Like, they wanted it for a while. And it seemed to them that Wong was like the perfect test case.
Okay.
So they argued that a, quote, accident of birth couldn't confer citizenship on the grounds that Wong's, quote, education and political affiliations remained entirely alien to the United States, which is a fucking lie because he was born here and educated here for 17 years.
What, like, literally, garbage. What the fuck does garbage. That even mean?
Yeah. It means that he is still, like, under a subject of China just because he's Chinese, even though he was
born.
It's literal garbage. But they thought that if they could get the Supreme Court to agree, countless American-born immigrants could be stripped of their rights, rounded up, and deported. They wanted to get rid of all of the Chinese, and they thought that, like, this case was the one. Like, they were really pushing it. But the Supreme Court sided with Wong.
Because they care about what the fucking Constitution says.
Well, no, definitely not. So, the aggressively white supremacist justices at the time, who just 2 years earlier had ruled that segregation was constitutional because black people were inferior, they could not argue against the plain language of the 14th Amendment. It was clear if they interpreted any differently, they would be forced to deny citizenship to millions of immigrants whose white skin made them American the moment they stepped off the boat.
So it's a double-edged sword. The language is too plain.
It's plain. All these English people, all these Dutch people, they're American because they are white once they come here. So if they said no immigrants, if you weren't born here, they couldn't become citizens.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they didn't do it because, like, oh, it's wrong to discriminate. The language, like you said, was too plain. All or nothing. If you're born here, you are a citizen. The end. Unfortunately, Wong would never get to freely enjoy the benefits of his citizenship. He was still, because of these racist laws, required to show extra documentation, including the signatures of white people affirming his birthplace every single time he came and left the country. Every single time.
For the rest of his life.
Yeah. For the rest of his life. He is believed, it's like he kind of fell off. He's believed to have gone back to China for good, dying there sometime after World War II.
Wow. Okay.
Because, I mean, why fucking bother? But despite Wong winning this nation-defining case, the Chinese Exclusion Act would not be repealed until 1943.
43?
Correct. So it was only repealed when the U.S. allied with China against the Japanese. So they weren't like, oh, we're doing this wrong thing. It's like, oh, we need the Chinese as an ally. And also we're busy interning the Japanese. It was because they needed Chinese support in the war.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 61 years they were barred. The Chinese specifically.
Holy fucking shit.
Yeah. So the Chinese Exclusion Act started a new era in which the U.S. changed from a country that welcomed almost all immigrants to a gatekeeping one. And this legacy is still here with us. There are still many people who believe, as that turd John Wise did, that America should not have so many immigrants, especially non-white ones. However, the fact remains that Wong Kim Ark was the American who challenged the U.S. government to affirm birthright citizenship, and no one knows his name. He's the reason why anyone born here, regardless of their skin color, is a citizen, automatically. Wow. Wong Kim Ark. Yes, he did this.
Wow.
So it's utterly shameful that we don't know his name. He was a hero who continued the long legacy of other patriots of color who stood up and said, what you're not going to do is this.
Yeah.
Believe that.
Wow.
What you're not going to do is this. And he made the country better for it. Yet people like him are too often left out of the history books, left out of the photos.
Yeah.
This racial exclusion law directly challenged our supposed foundational principles. So it's no wonder we weren't taught this in school.
I mean, we should.
Yeah.
We do need to.
It's critical to know our past so we stop repeating it or we stop being shocked by it when we see it.
But the people who write textbooks don't want to draw attention to these
kinds of stories. Whole race was banned and that this reflects our character as a nation and it reflects the way this country has developed. I mean, we're still in development. We are who we are as a nation because of Wong Kim Ark and the fact that we banned the Chinese for 61 years. And I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of. It's just history and it explains a lot.
I mean, it is something to be ashamed of, but it's like there's so many things that our country has done that are shameful.
But it just explains so much about what people are confused about. Like, this is just our history. It's plain. This is knowledge that we all have access to with the internet now. I heard this quote on a podcast once that maybe it's like an Irish proverb, but the thing about the past is that it's not the past.
Yeah.
It's right here with us.
I mean, literally and figuratively in the United States, we've just traded one group for another.
Exactly.
If it's not the Chinese, it's black
someone
people.
Else.
If it's not black people, it's Mexican Americans. If it's
white
not
group.
If it's not Mexicans, it's Muslims.
Yeah, like, exactly. So I encourage everyone listening who wants to learn more about Wong Kim Ark, and you should, that you watch this documentary on PBS. It's called The Chinese Exclusion Act. It's part of PBS's American Experience series. It's really, really good. I got the bulk of my information from this documentary. But it is a lot.
Yeah.
Like, the speed at which, like, contemporary things, like, hit you in the face like bricks, it's hard.
Yeah.
But it's really necessary. It's almost 2 hours long. But it's so, so good.
I mean,
it's so good. Like, watch it. Drink water. Stretch. Moisturize. Cry if you need to. But, like, watch it because it's so important and it explains everything.
Yeah. Make yourself a Martinez and
yeah,
saddle up.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. The end.
Take Lizzo breaks like we did in the last episode if you need to.
Oh, I took many Lizzo breaks watching this documentary.
These things are things that we should know.
Yes.
But we
don't. Should have been known.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here we are.
Damn.
All right. Now I can drink.
Yeah. Mine's almost empty. I know you
mine
didn't
is
really
not,
get
no,
to.
Mine is not, no, because I was trying to be responsible.
It's hard going first because you can't drink.
No.
But, however.
What?
However.
However.
Then you get to sit back and relax and just sip away.
Oh, yes.
I would argue going second is harder because you want to drink the whole time.
Yeah.
And then by the time you get to your story, you're like, oh, fuck, now I'm drunk.
Yes. Correct. Yes. Yeah. Every single time it's like, oh.
Wait a minute. Alcohol does what to me?
Yeah. Now I can let my gut out
and
relax and drink and have fun.
Well, I'm about to tighten my Spanx. All right. BRB. Feeling good, looking great.
Okay.
I don't know. This cocktail is so fucking good.
It's so good.
It's like sweet. And
but not too sweet.
It's not too sweet, but it's cherry, but vermouth kind of like warmth.
Yeah, the vermouth is, it goes really well with the cherry.
You barely even taste gin. It doesn't
taste
like gin.
I don't taste any gin.
I think it's because it's the old Tom gin and not the...
I just taste vermouth and cherry.
Yeah.
And like
for people who like Manhattans... This cocktail is fucking amazing.
Yeah. No,
if you're not
it.
Like a strong liquor person, if you're not a Manhattan drinker, you might not like this. But it's too delicious.
It's really, really good.
I guess I have to talk.
Good luck with that.
Tighten my corset. The story I'm doing today, first of all, I feel like, again, unplanned. We always do this. Unplanned.
What? They match
your mirror? This is like Beyond Reproach racist edition.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Into it.
So the story today I'm doing is
yeah. I'm sorry. Again, the alcohol has made my laughs like 10 seconds to late.
Yeah, you're on a delay.
I'm just like, ha, 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 racism.
Hilarious. America, etc.
Go on, I'm sorry.
So the story I'm telling today is much more contemporary than the types of stories I usually like to tell. It's one that I would say...
Like 80s?
More current than that.
Oh, okay.
It's one that I would say probably all of our listeners are familiar with in one way or another.
Okay.
The reason that I thought it was worth telling, though, is that I think a lot of people, while they do know that this happened, don't know all the details behind how and why it played out the way it did. This is a crazy fucking story. It's crazy.
I like the crazy. People are tuning in for the crazy.
Yes. So this is a scandal so heinous.
Ooh.
And so disturbing.
Uh-oh.
That it rocked the foundations of an entire administration and shook the very nation to its core.
Okay, that is a strong statement. That feels like hyperbole, but maybe not.
We're going to be talking about
uh-oh.
Obama's tan suit.
Yes, thank you. Oh my god, oh no. Oh man, it's funny because it's true.
Yeah.
Oh man, stupid.
Stupid. Damn, I'm drunk.
Okay. Oh, what a fun story. I already love this. I don't know anything about this other than like it made no sense to me.
It makes no sense.
It made no sense to me. And I knew that it was a scandal, but I'm like, but why?
Yeah, exactly.
He's foine.
Like. Yeah, this is why I wanted to tell the story, because people know that it happened. We're still talking about it. But like,
we are still talking about
why?
It. I don't know.
Yeah.
You will tell me.
So on August 28th, 2014... President Barack Obama stepped up to the podium.
A day that will live in infamy.
Yes, exactly.
What was it? August 20 what?
August 28th, 2014.
Oh, yes. Wow.
One for the history books.
Never forget.
Yes. I have that on the back of my car.
There's like an outline of Obama, it's someone a suit, in a silhouette says, in a tan suit.
Yes.
Never forget.
Yeah. So President Obama stepped up to the podium for a press conference. He wanted to talk about the economy, the threat of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and what to do about Russian violence against Ukraine. At this point, we already had a strategy in place of targeted airstrikes in Iraq. These airstrikes were working to destroy arms and supplies. And also, Iraqi and Kurdish forces were working with us to help push back the terrorist threat in their country. But as ISIS's hold over Iraq was beginning to diminish, their roots in Syria were starting to expand, and people were freaking out about it. There was a report released that there had been planes were flying over Syria in an effort to survey potential airstrike targets. So there was all this speculation that the Obama administration planned to, like, we were already doing these airstrikes in Iraq, but there was speculation that we were about to start doing it in Syria, too. So Obama, I would say the biggest reason that he held this press conference, there were other things that he wanted to talk about, but the biggest reason was he wanted to talk about what we were doing in Syria. He got up in front of everybody and said, you know, at the moment, we're weighing our options in Syria, but currently, for the moment, airstrikes are going to remain limited to Iraq, at least for right now. The main focus for the moment was going to be focusing on keeping our people, our troops or whatever in Syria safe while we figured out what the next step was going to be.
Okay.
So that was his message. Then the floor opens up to questions. Somebody asks
Why are you wearing a tan suit?
Yes.
Excuse me, Stephanie from NPR. You look good.
The fuck?
But why are you wearing a tan suit?
Yeah. So when pushed on what the strategy in Syria was really going to be, he said, you know, he had asked his defense secretary and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to prepare a range of options for him for confronting ISIS, and they were working together to figure out what they were going to do.
Okay.
But at the moment, he said, we don't have a strategy yet. Now, because Americans are not super great at subtlety and
Things being ambiguous.
Yeah, and we don't really understand the complexities that go into military operations or political moves. The media and the press decided to jump on those six little words. We don't have a strategy yet.
Oh.
Became a rallying cry for the right to use against Obama. Michelle Bachmann tweeted, not having a strategy perfectly sums up the foreign policy approach of President Obama's entire presidency. And John McCain tweeted, we don't have a strategy yet. President Obama, 8/28/14, hashtag ISIS is the largest, richest terrorist group in history, and 192,000 dead in hashtag Syria.
Okay.
ABC News said, Obama's blunt admission that we don't have a strategy yet landed with a thud. The White House press secretary had
They didn't have a strategy yet. Like, it's okay.
It just started happening. Yeah. Like, he's just coming out to say, like, we recognize it's a threat.
He's not flying from the seat of his pants like people we know.
His tan pants.
From his beautiful tan pants. His sculpted from basketball derriere in those tan pants. I don't want to sexualize former president.
Sure you do.
But I do.
Like, literally, he's saying, like, we just figured out this is a problem and we're working on it.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, well, you don't have a strategy yet? What the fuck?
It's like, you're supposed to lie.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's basically the whole point.
You're supposed to lie.
That was not a part of his statement. It was something he said.
He's over here telling the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
And people are just like, but lie to us.
Then the White House press secretary came out, like, trying to do damage control and was like, no, there is a strategy.
We're working on it.
But it's evolving.
Yeah.
And the Pentagon is developing a plan and Obama is still reviewing it.
People are thinking about things. Imagine that. What?
We're not going to just, like, go. Yeah.
Things that take time.
But it was too late. What was done was done.
I mean, he should have just been tweeting.
Exactly. Well, this was also at a time when we still had press briefings.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. They weren't from the toilet.
Yeah. So these policy experts came out. Somebody was quoted as saying, no matter what Obama meant Thursday, his omission of no clear-cut strategy only serves to embolden the likes of ISIS.
Oh, wow. That's strong.
But the real thing is that this is not what Americans were focusing on after this press conference. What seemed to have been a routine press conference right before Labor Day was not. What was really getting under people's skin was not Syria policy or lack thereof, but the color of Obama's light tan suit. During the press conference, Twitter lit up. Before he even said, we don't have a strategy yet, Twitter was already lit up. It started innocently enough with a few clever puns.
Ooh.
I know you love a pun.
I don't.
Psych.
Thank you for saying yeah. Psych.
I do love a pun, though. The audacity of taupe. And yes, we... yes.
So, okay, you guys, as shown by my belly laughter, love a pun, but also I think I'm better than puns. Yeah. They hit me, and then I laugh, and then I feel sad because I'm better than this.
It got you. The pun got you.
They all, yeah.
So it was the audacity of taupe and yes, we tan were the two that were really big.
Oh.
But then...
I'm sorry. Come on.
No, that's hilarious. I need to take another fucking sip.
That is hilarious.
But then... Congressman Peter King, a Republican from Long Island.
Oh!
Do you know Peter King?
Sure do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go off on my Peter King. He's just, yeah, he's one of many who are just really extra racist.
Yeah.
Like, not even trying to pretend.
He's separate from Steve King.
I know! Right? Yes. Oh, who's worse?
I would say Steve King is probably worse.
Yeah.
Steve King is definitely worse,
He's
actually.
Definitely worse. You're right.
Anyways.
The Kings are... Go on.
Other than Martin Luther.
I was about to say, when I said the Kings, I'm like, not
yeah,
all.
Exactly.
Not all.
Yeah, yeah. So Peter King was a Republican congressman from Long Island, New York.
Long Island.
Crazy that, but Long Island is a different place than New York City.
Very different place. It's suburban.
Immediately after this press conference, he was on an interview. I think he was already scheduled to be like, this wasn't like. Because of the press conference, he was already supposed to be there, but then he used the press conference to kind of like get people to pay attention to him because nobody cared about him. So he said that the tan suit was a metaphor for Obama's lack of seriousness on fighting terrorism. And that he, quote, looked like he was on his way to a party at the Hamptons.
Oh.
The very next day, King...
I like that he's pretending that he knows what a metaphor is.
So the very next day, he appears on this right-wing internet TV news show that, like...
Yeah, because he's...
It's an internet TV news show.
That's
no
amazing.
One is watching the shit.
But that's appropriate of his, like, level of seriousness.
Yeah, exactly. The show is called Newsmax TV.
Oh, yes.
Famous Newsmax TV.
Emmy Award winning.
Yeah, exactly. So he goes on Newsmax TV and he says, quote, there's no way, I don't think... any of us can excuse what the president did yesterday. I mean, you have the world watching. For him to walk out, I'm not trying to be trivial here, in a light suit, a light tan suit.
What?
And he's trying to act like, you know, real Americans care about the economy.
What?
Not about ISIS and not about terrorism.
I'm so confused.
And then he goes on to say that he has no strategy.
What?
ISIS is watching. If you were the head of ISIS, if you were Baghdadi, if you were anyone in the ISIS,
oh,
would you come away from yesterday afraid
the
of the
ISIS,
United States?
Like the Ohio State University. Did you know that it's the Ohio State?
No,
and not
I did
just
not know
Ohio
that.
State. It's so weird.
Would you be afraid that the United States was going to use all its power to crush ISIS, or would you think, here's a person who's going to go out and do a few fundraisers over the Labor Day weekend? And with that stupid fucking little piddly internet news TV show that nobody had even heard of and no one was watching other than fucking Steve Bannon or some shit.
Yeah.
The floodgates were open.
Huh.
Major cable news shows held roundtable discussions on Obama's choice of suit.
What?
Roundtable discussions.
They brought in. But isn't there like a war happening?
We're talking about fucking Syria and targeted airstrikes and no.
Why are we
tan suit.
Because America.
Suit. Yeah.
Because America.
Fashion critics and image consultants were brought in to discuss whether or not the choice of suit was appropriate or not. TV news reporters conducted man-on-the-street interviews in Northeast Ohio.
Oh, no.
To find out what people thought. No!
Why are you telling me this? Why are you trying to hurt me?
Fox News' Lou Dobbs said that the suit was unpresidential.
Stop there. Yeah. Lou Dobbs cannot say anything. The man is still pretending that he's blonde. Okay? Lou Dobbs, you're an old man.
Go away already.
Seriously. Ew.
So he said that Obama's suit was unpresidential and then tried to say that Obama, literally, I can't even, tried to say that Obama was actively trying to send a secret hidden message.
What?
Possibly to our enemies.
Through his suit?
Through the color of his suit as a signal.
A signal to what? Like,
to like ISIS, to be like, we don't care. Go ahead. So the tweet storm that had started innocently enough with the audacity of Taupe had morphed into tweets like hashtag beige Ghazi.
No.
Yes.
No.
GQ said the suit was terrible. And Esquire called it
GQ?
A...
GQ?
Yes.
GQ? That has nothing but tan suits? Like...
I know. Esquire called it a monstrosity. A monstrosity.
But why? But it's
good
just,
fucking question. Gawker had an article, the headline of an article... President Obama shames America by wearing whack-ass tan suit.
Okay. What white person wrote that terrible headline?
The White House press secretary tried to, like, make jokes about it on Twitter, but it was too late. Even The Atlantic was in on it.
Well, I guess it's just everyone is talking about it, so you want to like, seem, yeah. like, relevant exactly. by talking about utter nonsense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How no, dare totally. They demean they just had themselves? To, like, in that way.
So
like Esquire, like you're not a real your fashion. And for you to be calling a suit bad is like garbage. But yeah. like The Atlantic should be better.
So the Atlantic headline was no one heard anything Obama just said because his tan suit was so loud. Like, from the article. The article's actually it says President Obama gave an important press conference and even took questions from the press. But all of this was overshadowed by the fact that Obama debuted one of the ugliest suits in the history of this great nation.
It's not ugly, though. This is crazy to me.
Instead of debating the validity of our foreign policy in the Middle East, Eastern Europe, or Central America, Twitter abandoned its usually academic tone.
Ah! I love The Atlantic. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Twitter abandoned its usually academic tone Amazing. To focus on whether the tan or beige suit was awful, fittingly summary, or a sign to our enemies abroad that we're weak.
Okay, so they're being funny.
Yeah, yeah.
They're being funny. Yeah. Okay, so I accept their take on this.
Today, it feels like this, quote, scandal
yeah.
was a million fucking years ago. In reality, this was 2014. This is less than 6 years ago.
Shit.
The issue is that the political landscape has changed so much since 2014
yeah.
that people like to use the tan suit scandal as a metaphor.
It does seem like so long ago when you said, like, beige Ghazi. I'm just like, no, but Benghazi was recent.
Yeah.
And this was, like, ancient history.
Yeah, no, same era.
Wow.
People like to use this scandal as sort of a metaphor for the differences between Obama's administration and the current one.
What current one? I have no president.
Yeah, exactly.
A girl has no president.
The thing is, this was not the only scandal of the Obama years.
Like, oh, Michelle NSA surveillance. Obama's like, arms?
I know. Well, that's
the
another,
one that I'm
yeah.
thinking of. Yeah. Like, that's all I'm thinking of.
Yeah. But there were some real scandals, yeah. not as big as like some of the bigger ones that we've discussed on
Her
the
biceps,
show, but there
yes.
were, yes, exactly. But there were some things that were, NSA surveillance is
yeah,
probably like
yeah,
the
yeah.
one that I.
And all the drone strikes.
Totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Terrible.
The thing is, under the current administration, every day brings a new scandal, each one crazier than the last.
There's a horse loose in a hospital.
Yeah. So it's like, yes, this is why we're using this as a metaphor for like what things were like 6 years ago versus how
days.
They are now. So today, I really want to talk about like the reasons that people thought that it was so such a big to-do that he wore this tan suit.
Okay.
First, I want to talk about the suit itself and like why it felt so remarkable for people to see Obama wearing a tan suit, like why people cared in such a big way. So some fashion experts came out
I
and said...
I don't understand this at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get there. But so these fashion experts, or some fashion experts, came out and said that the suit itself, beyond the color, that the suit looked cheap and ill-fitted, which is fucking bullshit. They said that it looked too big on him.
It didn't.
But like, yeah. Has anybody seen what the current president...
I was just about to say, I'm like, he got his shit from Sears. Like,
and it nobody's looks, talking about that.
I mean, yeah, because, yeah.
Because he's white.
You said it, not me.
Yeah. This suit had been specifically fitted for Obama by Georges de Paris, a tailor who had fitted Obama for every single suit he wore for his entire presidency.
Yeah.
And not only that, Georges de Paris had been in charge of fitting every single president in the White House since Lyndon B. Johnson.
Damn! Oh, wow. That is
garbage. So suddenly he makes this one suit and it's cheap and ill-fitted?
Yes.
But every other suit since Lyndon B. Johnson totally has been fine.
Totally fine on those bodies and those colors.
So clearly, definitively, the suit is not cheap and ill-fitted.
Why
so
would it
was
be?
It the color? Well, no. But also, yes. Was this the first time that a president had worn...
It cannot be.
No, absolutely not.
It cannot be.
Absolutely not.
Because the range for male suits are so limited that tan is just part of the mix.
Yes,
it's absolutely. Always been part of the mix.
Yeah. Guess out of all the presidents, well, JFK. Like sort of modern presidents who loved tan suits.
Reagan.
Of course.
Loved
tan suits.
But Reagan was white.
Yeah.
So, right, yeah. the tan suits are for the white man.
Yeah.
For the pale man.
Because the tan suit looks too good on brown skin. So it's a crime.
I mean, factual. Okay. Oh, now I understand. Completely understand. We can just end this here.
The end. Goodbye.
He looked too good.
Yeah. No, but so Reagan, like, wore tan suits, like, he wore them casually around the White House. He wore them during press conferences.
Oh, of course he did.
He wore them when meeting important dignitaries and politicians.
Wow.
He wore them to meet Australian Prime Minister Bob Hawke.
Did he wear them to signal to Syria that...
Yes, that we're weak. Yes. I love jelly beans.
Yes! Jelly beans are delicious.
He wore them to meet Australian Prime Minister Bob Hawke, Sandra Day O'Connor, and he also wore them during an historic meeting with Pope John Paul II during the Cold War. Eisenhower also wore tan suits. So did George Bush, Senior and Junior.
What? Okay, so did this Bill is Clinton. Garbage. This is truly insane to me.
Yes. Mitch McConnell has been photographed in a tan suit.
No one's talking
so
about
So has
that
Rudy Giuliani. And so have countless other high-ranking politicians.
I don't know these people.
We have countless photographs of mayonnaise in a tan suit.
Ew.
Like blocks of cream cheese with a face.
Maybe it is because he looked too good.
Time magazine at the time wrote that seeing Obama in a tan suit was, quote, tantamount to seeing a performer out of costume.
What?
But why?
Well,
they're not wrong. The thing is, unlike Reagan, Obama did not wear tan suits.
No, he didn't. Because
he never did.
Michelle wouldn't let him.
Well, yeah. Really?
Well, black people have to be better.
Yeah.
We have to project an image that's unnaturally better in all senses of the word.
Yeah.
We have to be twice as good to get half as far.
But
so,
it's a tan suit. Who gives a shit?
I think black women are very acute because we're a double minority. We're not the only double minority, but it's like we see how we understand optics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, you are at this level and like, yes, Reagan and like all these other people can wear tan suits, but not you because you're black.
Michelle literally said, don't.
Told him not to wear that suit.
Wow.
Told
I didn't
him
know
not
that.
To
that
wear
was
that.
Not a part of
yeah,
my
it was in her
research.
Latest,
wow.
It was in her memoir that she told him and he's like, it's just a suit. And she's like, okay.
Damn.
Listen to your wives.
Yeah. So, in a Vanity Fair profile from 2012, Obama was asked about his routine in the White House, and he said, quote, you need to remove from your life the day-to-day problems that absorb most people for meaningful parts of their day. You'll see that I only wear gray or blue suits. I'm trying to pare down decisions. I don't want to make decisions about what I'm eating or wearing because I have too many other decisions to make.
So, sorry to interrupt.
No.
But I haven't read her book yet, but my sister has read it, and she talks about all of of the painstaking decision she had to make regarding the way that she looked.
Yeah.
Because she is a woman.
She was attacked for wearing bare sleeves. And she is a black woman.
Like, so it's just like hours of her day were spent projecting her next, what she was going to wear outside the next day.
Yeah.
Whereas Barack could just wake up and wear a black suit and be fine.
Well, this is also probably part of it. He doesn't say that specifically in his profile because
he never thought about.
You can't say that because people don't want to hear that racism is a thing.
I mean, yeah, I guess
in a Vanity Fair, if he said I have to wear like a pared down wardrobe,
she talks about like he didn't even really think about it like that. But also, he's just a man.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it too. Like, you don't have to think about crafting an image, whereas like a black woman and like the first lady, you have to be an image.
There's so much more. You can't wear the same dress over and over and over and over and over in the way that a man can wear the same suit.
Over and over and over and over.
Whereas a woman, if you were to do that, they'd be like, well, she's unimaginative or like boring or whatever. Just, she would be ripped to shreds for that.
Or but then she's she's looking too sexy. Yeah, like her hair is down and she's wearing a V-cut. Like all these things that like... She would have to project her image, her dress, and her hair. Nothing could be too sexy.
Yeah.
Or too nice.
Yeah.
Because it's like you're trying to hit this market.
Totally.
It's just insane. She was just lamenting that, you know, my husband can just roll out of bed and put on a black suit.
Yeah. So he goes on in the same Vanity Fair profile to say that he read some research that shows that the simple act of making decisions can impair your ability to make further decisions throughout your day. He said... You need to focus your decision-making energy. You need to routinize yourself. You can't be going through the day distracted by trivia. My wife makes fun of how routinized I've become.
Yes, no, that's correct. But I do understand what he's saying, and he's such a like intellectual, but I could see that him like just trying to whittle away the things that he doesn't need to think about.
Because
to
he's focus a fucking president of the United States.
And also he cares, too.
He's trying to do a good job.
Because he has to do a good job.
Yeah. Yeah.
He can't just be because a fucking mess. Because he has
to
do
twice as good of a job as anyone else to even be recognized. Yeah. But so in this effort to sort of streamline his life and pare down all these decisions so that he can save the mental energy required of being the
most
amazing president. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
I couldn't imagine.
In doing this, he created an image of himself. And the image was so constant.
Yes.
That seeing him in a different color... really did feel like you were seeing a performer out of character. It didn't matter what the color was.
It's not like he was in sweatpants.
No, I know, but it was just like visually jarring after he was in office for several years and people were used to seeing him in these dark, serious suits. And then suddenly he's in a light suit. Shock, you know.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been that big of a deal. It started with these, like, puns. Or, you know, Yes We Tan.
And Yes We Tan is hilarious.
It wouldn't have gone to Beige Ghazi if it hadn't been for Peter King. There is a reason that things, like, got to this place. And that reason, of course, is racism.
Duh.
Specifically, the reason is... the open and vocal racism of certain key political figures who are not afraid to use racism as a tool for distraction and diversion.
Yeah, I mean, racism is the... It works.
It really works.
It works. Yeah.
It's so easy.
It's so easy. And we've been doing it for hundreds of years that it's just right there.
And it's so American.
Yes.
Not that there isn't racism outside of...
There's racism outside of America, obviously, outside of the United States, obviously. But we're talking about this country and it was founded in racism.
I mean, look at the story you just told.
Yeah.
Like,
all of the stories are racist. Yeah. Like the foundational story, like the fact that... We discovered a place that had people who were living on this continent for millennia.
Yeah.
But we discovered it.
Yeah.
And we took it over. Like, that's racist.
Yeah.
There's this amazing meme that I see around Thanksgiving. And it's a picture of the country. And it's like, you got a nice country there. Yeah. It would be a shame if someone discovered it. And it's like a close-up of his face. Yeah. I laugh every year. It's still so funny because it's true. Garbage. But yeah, no, I do understand if you're like, if you're seeing President Obama wearing black suits and navy suits or charcoal gray suits, seeing a tan suit would be, it shouldn't be this destabilizing, but I kind of get, if you have a sort of mindset, I guess.
Americans also have a short attention span. So after years of seeing this, they're like, that's just what American presidents just wear dark suits.
So we just forget about like George W., who was like living in like on the ranch, like just being real casual about lots of things.
But he wasn't black.
I'm just going to stop talking to you guys because duh.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you're not wrong.
Yeah. Obviously, yes, it was a visual shock to see Obama in a tan suit. But the larger reason here is
a visual
is
shock
racism.
For white people. Because yeah. I heard about the scandal and I'm just like, he looks good and the suit looks good.
I think it also was not a visual shock for a huge number of people didn't even think about it.
Because why would you?
Yeah.
Like, why are we having roundtables about this?
Because of Peter King. While he was not the only person responsible for this shit, we do need to take a closer look at Peter King.
But why? He sucks.
To illustrate why this all played out the way it did.
Okay.
He's a well-known and outspoken racist.
Yes.
But he's also probably the one who is the most instrumental in getting this whole tan suit scandal, you know, getting the ball rolling on the whole thing. When it comes to, like, the news or responsible journalism, it is difficult to pin down any one single action and prove without a doubt that that action was motivated by racism. But if you zoom out and look at a person's actions and career as a whole, a legacy of racist comments and actions becomes much clearer and harder to deny.
Yeah.
Peter King has a well-documented history of vocal racism and hateful rhetoric. Peter King blamed Eric Garner for his own death. He said that if Garner hadn't been so obese, he probably wouldn't have died. And then went on to praise the grand jury for, quote, doing justice by not indicting the cop that killed him. Peter King has compared NFL players kneeling for the national anthem to protest racial injustice to Nazi salutes, to say the least. That's a stretch.
Yeah.
He also has said that there is a false narrative of police bias against black men.
Oh, okay.
That's easy for you to say as a fucking
white racist man
from Long Island.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has used racial slurs against Asian Americans on Fox News' Morning Joe. And he's also targeted the LGBTQ community, voting against marriage and adoption equality, and even voting against anti-discrimination laws.
Well, hate is hate. It all stems from the same river.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that he's just like, I hate everyone who's not white.
Well, this is
straight.
Like what we were saying in the last story, that you can replace one character with another. If they're not black, they're Chinese.
Yeah.
If they're not Chinese, they're
gay.
Native
American.
Yeah,
they're Muslim. They're fat. They're able. Yeah, they're not him.
Yeah, exactly. So most notable about King's career, though, is his extreme Islamophobia and his insistence on trying to tie the Muslim faith to terrorism despite his own ties to terrorism.
They're trying to institutionalize Islamophobia like they institutionalize racism. It's so,
no, I know.
So obvious.
Yeah. But the motherfucker has his own ties to terrorism. And he's trying to be like, those terrorists are brown, so those ones are bad.
Yes. Terrorism is not real terrorism.
Yeah. In the 1980s, Peter King was a fervent supporter of the terrorist group, the Irish Republican Army.
Oh, no. Wow.
In 1985, he even said that
IRA.
Yes.
Like Bond, okay.
Yeah, civilians. Exactly.
Huh.
In 1985, he said that he was comfortable with them murdering innocent civilians if that's what they needed to do. He said, quote, if civilians are killed in an attack on a military installation, it is certainly regrettable, but I will not morally blame the IRA for it. A judge in Belfast once threw King out of an IRA murder trial, calling him an obvious collaborator, and King also once complained that the Secret Service had been investigating him as a security risk because of his ties to terrorism. Between 1969 and...
What's wrong with my terrorism?
Yeah. So between 1969 and 1994, the IRA was responsible for the deaths of about 1,800 people, including roughly 600 civilians.
Yeah.
Shockingly, despite his terrorist ties, Peter King took over as chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in 2011.
I'm not shocked.
I think that's fucking scandalous.
Is it?
He's a fucking terrorist collaborator.
And he is now
the chairman of the
terrorism whole... is brown. It's for brown people.
I know.
So, but I guess it's, I mean, it's a double standard, but the double standard has always been there. So yeah. I'm not shocked at all.
Yeah. He quickly launched hearings on radicalization among Muslim, American Muslim communities. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee called it a way to demonize and castigate a whole broad base of human beings. Nobody was listening.
No one cares. You're a woman. Shh.
He has openly said that there are, quote, too many mosques in the United States, and falsely claimed that 85% of American mosques were controlled by extremist leadership.
Yes. His own statistics.
His own. That
He did the research, you guys. Don't look for his sources. He just did it.
He knows what they are, and that's all that matters.
Thank you.
He said that Muslim Americans don't cooperate with law enforcement.
What?
And that police should be infiltrating Muslim communities.
Well, they are.
For increased surveillance.
They are.
Probably under his direction. Peter King has also said that President George W. Bush should get a medal for torturing terror suspects.
What kind of medal is this? Like Steve
That medal
King's
doesn't exist.
Award for racism?
Exactly. Yes. This is the man who goes on TV and makes this jump from Obama's suit as a visual shock to a supposed signal to ISIS that the president of the United States is soft on terrorism. A few people at the time tried to look for like a silver lining in this whole thing and say that the way Obama's clothing was being criticized was sort of a win for women's equality. Vox even published an article with the headline, "The Obama Suit Backlash is a Promising Sign of Gender Equality."
Oh,
I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that the person who wrote that article was a white woman.
Duh. Such a white woman. not all white women. However,
she's the same woman from our minisode is using body positivity to say, like, it's okay that I have a little dimple in my butt in my yoga pants.
Yes.
Anyways, so the theory here is that since women in politics are constantly having their wardrobes dissected and discussed in nauseatingly tedious detail, seeing this happen to a straight man is somehow a sign of progress.
A straight black man.
Yes. So while it is true that straight men do not usually have to deal with this kind of bullshit.
It'd be progress to see it on a straight white man.
Well, so this is my thing is like, it's not progress
it's not
to
progress.
Go backwards.
Yeah, it's true.
It is not progress to see Obama having his wardrobe dissected. It would have been progress if men stopped criticizing women's wardrobe. Going backwards is not going
forward. No one's body should be there for like public consumption. Like you shouldn't have to dress to be heard.
Yeah.
Or to be seen in a certain way. You should be able to wear whatever you want and like not have your message like distorted because you're wearing a fucking tan suit. That's fitted and it looks real good.
This actually further illustrates the point that this would never have happened if it weren't for Obama's race.
Never. In a million years.
This is just one more way that straight white men can attempt to assert their power and their superiority over anyone who is not a straight white man.
It's white supremacy in action.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By focusing on such trivial details about a person, they're attempting to
trivialize
that person.
Yes.
Trivialize
their
authority.
It's not about the message.
Trivialize their credibility.
Yeah.
And also make it clear that they're not going to be taken seriously because they are not a straight white man.
Yes.
We're not going to take you seriously.
Yeah.
We're going to criticize you on whatever the fuck we feel like.
Whatever.
Because your message isn't important because you're not one of us.
Because you're not one of us. You don't look like us. Therefore, we can attack you on anything you do that steps out of line. And women do face this as well. But yeah, it's only because he's a black man.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's under this level of scrutiny that they're able to completely derail his message based on the fact that he's wearing a suit that many other presidents have worn.
Totally. Obama essentially loses his straight male privilege of not having to answer for his wardrobe choices.
Yeah.
Because it's outweighed by his race.
Yes.
And Peter King's racism.
Yeah.
Peter King, it should be noted, has also been known to wear a tan suit. So, like I said before, this scandal today is used most often as a metaphor for the squeaky clean image of the Obama administration. But the real story is shit today is so out of control.
Oof.
that even a war criminal like George W. Bush is somehow seen as more respectable and
more.
Softer somehow when compared to the current
administration. Insane.
So the real reason this scandal has endured for so long and is still being discussed today is the fucking absurdity of the whole fucking thing.
When it happened, I didn't get it, but then I got it because I'm like, oh, he's black.
Yeah.
But then it didn't die down. It took a while for it to die down. I'm just
But now it's popping back up.
Are we really
talking
about this?
Yeah. Now that we're under this new administration, I think a lot of liberals like to look back at it as like, well, see what you did when this happened and look at the way things are now and nobody's saying anything.
There has always been a double standard. I guess it's good that liberals are finally seeing it, but like it was there at the time, right there under the surface. On the surface.
Yeah. That's basically the end of the story. I do want to end on a quote from a Washington Post reporter, Jason Rezaian. The month before Obama's press conference in the tan suit, Rezaian was arrested in Iran on espionage charges and was convicted in an Iranian trial in 2015. He was released in 2016, and on the tan suit scandal's fifth anniversary in 2019, he tweeted his take on the whole mess. I was in prison when this happened. Today is literally the first time I'm hearing of it.
Oh, no. Oh, poor guy.
If this was actually a thing to be covered at the time, and now, we are indeed the most privileged and perhaps pettiest nation ever.
Facts on facts. Big facts there.
Big facts.
I feel so bad for him that he just found out. When he was imprisoned.
I mean, I feel worse for him for being in an Iranian prison.
I mean, duh, that too. But like, just the absurdity of it all.
Yeah.
To like, live through what he's lived through and then like, have this be the scandal.
And the fact that the whole thing was like, he was giving a press conference about ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And this man is in a prison in Iran.
Wow. Yeah, that is sobering-ish.
Yeah.
These drinks are very strong.
It's hard to get sober.
But I feel like this is the closest of sober I've been drinking these two cocktails. I'm like, ooh.
I thought it was an important story to tell, even though it's so stupid.
Stupid. Thank you.
I mean, the story itself, there are reasons that racism manifests itself the way it does. And I thought that it was worthwhile to look back at it and be like, this is why we're talking about this. Yeah. This is why.
Ugh, Pete King. Pete King trying to give the other king a run for his money. Literally. It's like, I'm going to out-racist you.
Yeah.
He hasn't, though. But it's hard. Oh my God. Hard. He's a high bar.
Recently, Chuck Schumer like praised Pete King as like a politician with integrity, and everyone roasted him. A lot of the facts I got about Pete King came from the articles that were like, what the fuck is wrong with Chuck Schumer?
He's too old. I'm glad they lit him up. Every time I think of Chuck Schumer, I think about his soup naps. We follow this person on Twitter. What is his name? Everyone needs to follow him.
No.
Ben, yes. Ben Rosen.
There we
go. Ben Rosen.
Yes.
Ben Rosen, he works for Funny or Die. He's hilarious. He's just always referencing Chuck Schumer's soup naps. And it's like, I don't even know if Chuck Schumer likes soup. But it's fucking funny and it fits.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so good. I mean, it is delightful. Yeah, what an asshole. Anyways, that was really good. Thank you for telling that story. Thank you.
I would argue yours was better.
They fit in well.
Yeah, we always say this, like, but Voltron, this was not planned.
When you said it was the tan suit, I'm like, oh my God, yes. Thank you. This is so good. But yeah, I guess our drinks are empty.
Almost empty-ish.
Our very strong drinks are almost empty. America's history is juicy. We just add gin and vermouth and fancy cherry Italian, what's it called?
Luxardo liqueur.
So, so good. We just add these things. Thank you so much to Tim Clough, our editor, our sound engineer, and our podfather. We could not do this without his hard work. I'm Stephanie Domingo.
I'm Tux Lerzel.
We out of here. Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.